Northwestern University, in cooperation with the Mutual Broadcasting System, presents The Reviewing Stand.
Northwestern University is celebrating its centennial year, 100 years of service to the nation and the great Northwest.
Today, The Reviewing Stand considers the problem of an aging population. Our unrehearsed give-and-take discussion will center around the question, can we grow old gracefully? Before turning the program over to our moderator, WGN, the originating station for this program, wishes to thank the Illinois Federation of Women's Clubs for a citation of merit awarded to radio station WGN in appreciation of its continued presentation of Northwestern University's Reviewing Stand, which program conforms to the standards established by the State Radio Department. Now our moderator, James H. McBurney, Dean of the School of Speech, Northwestern University, will introduce participants in today's discussion. Mr. McBurney.
Our speakers today are participating in the university's centennial conference on the problems of an aging population. We welcome to our microphone Clark Tibbetts, Chairman of the Committee on Aging and Geriatrics of the Federal Security Agency. Dr. C.H. Hardin Branch, Head of the Department of Psychiatry in the Medical School of the University of Utah. And Paul K. Hatt, Professor of Sociology at Northwestern University. Philip Hauser, gentlemen, Professor of Sociology at the University of Chicago, made this rather startling prediction in addressing this centennial conference we've been attending on the problems of an aging population. He said this: the number of persons 65 and older in the United States will increase from the present 12¼ million to between 17 and 20 million by 1975. Now, do you go along with that prediction, Hatt?
Well, there can be little doubt that this is an accurate prediction. Everyone is living who is going to be of this age at that time. In fact, the youngest is 41. We know mortality rates in that age group are not going to shift greatly between now and then, and we have very accurate figures on them. So it's quite possible to make a very accurate forecast of this kind. I don't think we can question it.
How do you account for our aging population, Tibbetts?
Well, there are a variety of factors that underlie it. The first one goes back 65 years or more to the time when we had a very high birth rate. That fell off beginning around 1880 or 85, so that we had fewer infants, young people, coming into the population. At the same time, the death rate was falling. And more recently, we practically cut off immigration to this country. Most of our migrants during the early part of this century were young people. We've now stopped feeding them into the population. Those who came in the earlier years are now part of our older population.
Now, our total population is increasing, I take it.
Our total population doubled between 1900 and 1950, but our older population quadrupled over that period of time.
Now, just who is this older population anyway? What do you mean by old age, Dr. Branch?
We don't know exactly, because we have a tendency to think of old people simply in terms of people who are older than we ourselves. And this same attitude toward old age starts at 2, perhaps. The child of 2 thinks of the boy of 16 as being quite an old person. Actually, in this group that we're discussing, of the 65 years and older people, there are certain physical findings which are simply part of the living process in general. This starts, as we said a little earlier, perhaps even before the child is born. The whole metabolic process of living involves this aging thing. Now, there's a great deal of exaggerated, and I think it's some misinformation, about the physical and psychological findings of these older people. They do have some changes in their blood vessels and in their internal organs and in their metabolism. But psychologically, we find that while they perhaps show a difference in adaptability, their vocabulary, their comprehension, their reasoning ability is remarkably good up until even quite an advanced age.
Now, you refer to the age 60 to 65. Why do you select that figure? Is chronological age, you think, an adequate criterion of aging? I've had 20-year-old students in my classes that I'm sure suffered from arteriosclerosis in one way or another. That is,
there are some pretty old young people,
right.
I think. I found them some very young old people. I think we'd all agree on that.
Well, is this figure 65 simply a convenience for purposes of discussing the problem? Is it wholly arbitrary as an estimate of age?
I would say it's almost entirely arbitrary, and I would say it's most unfortunate that in our society we have let 65 come to mark the beginning of what we've called old age. Dr. Branch just indicated that the physiological changes take place throughout life. Psychological changes take place throughout life. They're gradual. There isn't any point at which we become old. People change at different rates, and even within one individual, aging takes place at different rates. A large part of this old age business is our tendency to call people old, to regard people as old when really they aren't. When our children begin to try to manage for us, as though we're no longer capable, that's one of the points at which we necessarily begin to feel old. When we can't find a job anymore after 45 or 50 or whenever it happens, that's another social definition of aging, which isn't consistent with physiological and psychological findings.
There are certain institutional aspects of this that we might just look at very briefly. A society is set up in such a way that there are certain roles that must be fulfilled. And it seems to me that the older people are designated by a society as to what function. In some, it's when you become a grandfather. In some, it's simply when your children marry. I would suspect, in other words, it's not entirely arbitrary, although it may become arbitrary.
Dr. Branch,
I just wonder if, since the number of people in the country in this age group is increased, if this isn't one of the age groups we have to get used to, maybe we are not accustomed yet to the idea of being 65 and older, and consequently we regard it as a rather forbidding thing. We had to get used to being 16. We had to get used to being 5. All of us rather regretted moving on because it usually meant giving up something.
Well,
you men need more practice.
Are you men saying that it's possible to be young at, let's say, 70, Doctor?
Or 80, for that matter, and old at 18 when you come right down to it.
You think that people are less likely to be old at 65 today than they were, say, 50 or 75 years ago?
Yes, I think that would be true. Certainly, we have all sorts of examples around us. There are all kinds of people who are putting out a great deal of efficient, very productive work, much above the age of 65. A few years ago, of course, people simply didn't live to be that old, and consequently, they had to be. The few people who did live to be that old were in the nature of museum pieces and were treated that way.
Even if there were any magic in this year 65, which apparently we agree there is not, but let us say, even if it was a proper age for ceasing productive work 25 or 30 years ago, the economic basis for that has shifted. It's gone. It means that we must raise this question again. That is, the period of work during which you can save for your later years. You now have a longer life expectancy, and in the face of a long-range inflation, the income from the amount of money you can save is not sufficient, even if it were adequately arranged 20 years ago.
Well, aren't some, Dr. Tibbetts probably would know about this, isn't there a tendency in some industries to try to use an age index as a basis for retirement rather than just an arbitrary retirement age?
What's becoming known as functional retirement basis instead of a chronological retirement basis is gaining some currency in industry. By that, we mean that the individual slows down or retires from his work when he's no longer capable of carrying on, rather than when he reaches an arbitrarily selected birthday like 60 or 63 or 67.
What kind of problems are primary for these older people we're talking about? What is the essential problem we're discussing here, as you see it, Hat?
Well, this is not the full problem by any means, but certainly one of them is the basic economic problem of putting aside sufficient money to take care of the later years, not only from the individual's point of view, but to keep the whole nation's economy balanced. under these particular conditions we now face.
Another thing that comes into that, which of course ties in with it, is the fact that society in general doesn't value people just because they're old. And consequently, they lose something that we all need to keep us going, a feeling of being worthwhile, a feeling of self-esteem. That, of course, complicates the whole situation because we are likely to try to hold on to our jobs in order to maintain that, even when there's no economic reason for it. That produces irritation with the people who are younger than we who want our jobs. And it also makes us very defensive about adopting any attitude toward moving on away from the job to a fuller sort of thing.
Tibbetts, I'd like to go back, McBurney, and tie this up with the question you asked a few minutes ago. Are people less likely to be old at 65 today than they were 50 years ago? I think potentially people can be much younger at 65 than they were back in 1900 because our public health and medical practice has improved so vastly that potentially we can be healthy people. Now, whether or not we are depends to a considerable extent on how society regards us in our older years, as when we pass middle life. To me, the crux of the problem of aging in this country today is that we have not assigned satisfactory roles to people who have passed middle life. We tend to put them out of the labor force, and similarly, we tend to put them out of community activities. We feel that maybe they're too old to teach Sunday school classes anymore. We feel that that older people need to be managed by their children. It's certainly true that growing families of today don't have any function for older members within the family. Well, the net result of it is that we have a tendency to set older people aside and expect them to be happy and contented in a rocking chair.
Yet look at the thing that we learned during the last war when a lot of people who retired came back and took on productive jobs. Some of them we would have felt were quite beyond their physical capacity, yet they did them. And the improvement in some of those people, physically and psychologically, was remarkable. All of us, I think, have seen cases of that sort. And all of us have seen those same people when their services were no longer needed, because that emergency, at least, was over. They went rapidly downhill, and some of them have died as a result.
Do you counsel them, an older person, to keep productive, to keep active as long as possible?
As long as possible.
He's likely to live longer and be healthier as a result of it? Is that what you're
saying? I think that would be so.
You know, it's surprising that the death rate in this country and in other countries, too, goes down during a period of war, when presumably the services of physicians are not available to the extent they usually are, because so many physicians are in the military. I think probably the biggest factor is that more people have things to do that occupy them, and they don't have time to be sick.
But in normal times, can you keep these older people in the labor force?
Well, that's our challenge. That's what we're facing right now, not only in the labor force, but in community activities.
Is anything being done about that, to your knowledge?
There are a good many different things being done in different areas. There is one law school in San Francisco which makes a practice of hiring faculty from people who have retired from other institutions, but who still have a good many sound and solid years of teaching left.
Now, the normal procedure in industry, as I understand it, is to retire people at 65. Are you suggesting that they ought to be continued beyond 65? And if so, on what basis can you really do that?
I can't speak about it from the industrial point of view, but it seems to me that they might well be used as an extension of some of their activities. Perhaps, well, to give you an illustration, in Utah, as you know, the Mormon Church is a very powerful influence. It has a very advanced communal and social sense, and they can make job opportunities available for older people in community types of activities which actually work to benefit other people who are We all see people who are poorly fed, poorly housed, poorly clothed, and it seems to me that many of the older people could be used in some sort of cooperative activities of things like that.
Very many industries are actually following that same lead. We've been reading recently about developments of gradual retirement programs in which the time on the job is cut down and part of the time released to be given to the community and community service. The proportions gradually shifting then so that the individual takes on a heavier community responsibility as his industrial responsibility slackens.
Now, why would it be possible to throw this... Now, this may be naive, and I'm on my own here. Might it not be possible just to throw out this retirement at 65 and keep people on the job as long as they're able to produce? Why not?
Well, I think that's what we're headed toward, and the chief obstacles are purely social ones. A great many persons who are responsible either for keeping people on or for hiring them, that is, personnel people, are operating under what we might call superstitions about the nature of old age. And personnel people are learning every day that these notions that we build up about the desirability of younger people and the lack of the capacity of older people are to a large extent wrong. So there's an educational process there. There's also one among us. The public is in no small way responsible for the failure to use older people. On the whole, I think we don't like to be served by older people who are as salespersons, waitresses, and receptionists in other positions. We prefer younger people. Now, if we can change our own attitudes generally, employers are more likely to take on and keep older people.
Well, isn't it possible, Clark, that if we have this arbitrary attitude toward older people, that we may move the thing down to the point where it becomes dangerous to really a much younger age group? For instance, take the individual who at 45 or so loses his job due to a change in the company situation or something of that sort. Doesn't that make him less employable, even though we don't regard him as an older person, even in this arbitrary sense of the word?
I mean, he becomes less employable because he's 45 and looking for a job?
Yes.
Was that your point? He becomes less employable, I would say, because of this social definition of old age. He knows from experience of his parents and other people that he's going to have difficulty getting a job. He knows he has a strike or two against him, so he has that problem to overcome. And for that, we are beginning to develop counseling services for older people. And one important function of that service is to build up their own confidence in themselves.
But as you extend the productive period for these older people in industry, aren't you running the risk of denying adequate opportunities to the young people who are coming on? Putting the question another way, are there enough jobs to go around? If you enlarge our labor force, as this suggestion of yours would presumably do.
Well, I think that we can see clearly that here is one of the hopeful signs, in a sense. That is, up to this time, we have had an exceedingly large proportion of our population in the so-called productive years, 20 to 60, however you happen to measure them. But that proportion is shrinking for the reason that Tibbetts mentioned earlier. And as a consequence, the relative size of the labor force to the total population is decreasing under present retirement policies. Now, the British, who are farther along in this demographic process than we are, in the Royal Commission's report of last year, has already clearly, outspokenly raised the question, can we not raise at least the tradition of retirement to age 70? That's still arbitrary, but it's 5 years later, at least.
The point that I think should be emphasized about this whole thing is that let's don't have a tendency to feel that we're dealing with an age group which is apart from us simply because none of us happens to belong to it. This whole problem of the age group 65 and older is going to have its repercussions and its effects clear through the... This is a total social problem. It's not a problem of a specific group as though we were talking about people with poliomyelitis or
or mentally defective people or a special group of that sort. We're dealing with a total thing which is going to have its effect all the way up and down the age group.
Now, how about the person, though, who has, I hate to say never been gainfully employed, because I'm thinking of the housewife, and I know...
You can't call her unproductive.
No, I know that Mrs. McBurney would take real exception to
hear about
that.
When you get home.
She thinks she's gainfully employed, I'm sure of that. But really, how about the older women who have maintained the family? Their family is gone, they reach the age of 65 or older. What do you suggest for those people?
Well, you know, I think we might point out that particular group is increasing more rapidly than the total older population segment. The life expectancy of women is about 4 years longer than that of men. So that the group you just mentioned now represents the largest single element in the aging population, and certainly they do have a problem, as you have indicated. Their household responsibilities decline as their children grow up and leave home. And they haven't been working for a good many years, at least, outside of the home in gainful employment. And just how is their, are their situations going to be met? I'd like to report that yesterday, downtown in the department store, I ran across a saleswoman who was in the latter half of life, and I was bold enough to ask her why she was working. Well, her answer wasn't because I need the money. Her answer was, my daughters have grown up and married and left home. There's nothing for me to do around the house all day long, and I was just beside myself for company. So I came down here and got this job, and I enjoy it. I enjoy being with people all day long.
Where do you think a woman of the sort you just described should live to move into another area of our problem? Should she live with her children? Should she try to maintain a home of her own? How about that, Doctor?
Well, there is simply a problem. There are many old people will tell you that they want to stay in their own homes. But they mean by that usually that they want to stay in an accustomed situation around their own furniture, their own friends, and so on. Actually, our present urban living doesn't allow for three-generation homes. Most of our homes won't support it. And the fact that parents and children...
In other words, we have smaller houses now that can hardly accommodate grandparents. Is that right?
And the stream of traffic through the home is usually arranged in such a way that people simply get in each other's hair. And the person that Clark mentioned, who's brave enough to tell her children, I don't need you, I want to get out on my own, I want to be independent, is, of course, a person who's found a very beautiful solution to this whole problem.
But going right along with it is also the fact that the number of functions performed in the household has decreased, so that the additional value of adults in the household is considerably less than it was during a period when we were not so urbanized or even presently in a rural situation.
And that brings up that same business about being needed again. When the older person feels realistically that they are not needed around, except as babysitters, and most grandparents object strenuously to being left by the television to watch the children.
Well, I suspect then it's wise, as far as possible, for older people to maintain their own home. That is essentially what you're saying.
I saw some figures on that the other day, that those, from a study made in Des Moines, that those older people who lived in their own homes were by far the better adjusted of the group which was surveyed there.
But, of course, each of us faces a time, I imagine, when we aren't capable of that kind of independence. We become infirm. We can't live alone. Well, where do we go? Are we going to live with our children? Are you going to set up institutions? How do you answer that problem? To me, it's an awfully important thing.
There you run into a thing that I think needs to be emphasized again, that older people are not sick people. If older people become sick, then they have to be handled as sick people in any age group, and consequently they may need nursing home care, they may need institutional care. But the problem of the older person is not necessarily the problem of a mildly sick person, because many of them are not even mildly sick in that sense of the word. Now, the infirm, people who are crippled by some incapacitating disease present a straight medical social problem like any other sick person.
I think that group is a very small minority of the older population. Those who spend years and years in an incapacitated condition in bed or homebound. But by and large, older people, even in their later years, are able to live satisfactorily in their own homes. Sometimes they get to the point where it's desirable for the community to provide services that will help them, such as having older people come in as visitors. To provide some company or companionship. Another kind of service is bringing in a hot meal a day. There may be an older couple living alone in their own home, and one of them incapacitated, the other one fully occupied taking care of them and doesn't have time to cook. Well, if the community on a volunteer basis would bring one balanced meal in per day, it would enable that couple to go on indefinitely.
Well, you're suggesting that so far as possible, we should, society should organize such a thing, organize things in such a way as to try to keep people in their own homes rather than in institutions of one kind.
No, that's where they want to be. It's almost the unanimous testimony of older people that they want to maintain their own living independence. That is, they want to manage for themselves in their own dwelling unit.
How adequate are our nursing homes and facilities for aged anyway?
Well, unfortunately, there are not enough of them, and unfortunately, a great many that there are inadequate. I think Dr. Branch has had some recent contact with that situation.
Of course, I have had a chance to check a few of them, and while they do provide an answer to a need, they certainly don't have adequate nutritional and medical care, except in those which are private and consequently are too expensive for most of us. I also object pretty strenuously to the idea of putting older people with minimal changes in mental institutions just because we have no other place to use as a depository.
Is that being done?
About 20% of our mental hospital beds are occupied by older people, and most of those people don't need to be in mental hospitals at all. They could be taken care of in adequate nursing homes or perhaps in their own home with the kind of supervision that Clark's talking about.
Dr. Branch had just mentioned the human aspect of confining older people to mental hospitals. There is the other side of it, too. Nearly every state in the Union, I think, at the present time is confronted with the demands for more hospital beds in mental hospitals. A good many physicians and psychiatrists are expressing themselves freely that if we provided foster homes and other arrangements to keep people in the community, we could save the cost of building these institutions.
Dr. Branch, you think it's possible and wise for people to make some kind of preparation for old age?
I think the person who does make a preparation for adequate living all the way through his life is going to have his preparation for old age. It's only going to be the individual who puts all his eggs in one basket of interest or occupation or family relationship who's going to have difficulty when he grows older.
I'm sorry, gentlemen, but our time is up. You've been listening to the Northwestern University Reviewing Stand discussion, Can We Grow Old Gracefully? Why not send now for a printed copy of this broadcast with a list of books and articles about the subject discussed. Copies may be purchased for 10 cents in coin. A subscription to the Reviewing Stand costs $1 for the next 4 months, $2.50 for an entire year. Write to the Reviewing Stand, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois. That address again, the Reviewing Stand, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois. Our guests today were Dr. C.H. Harden Branch, Clark Tibbetts, and Paul K. Hatt. Now our moderator, James H. McBurney, will tell you about next week's program.
Next week, the Reviewing Stand discusses the question, does advertising provide a better way of life? Our guest will be John S. Maddox, assistant to the president of Fuller and Smith and Ross, Incorporated. Cy Berg, president of the Iron Fireman Corporation. And Richard Wallum, professor of psychology at Cleveland College of Western Reserve University.
We invite you to listen next week for a discussion of the question, does advertising provide a better way of life?
The Northwestern University Reviewing Stand is broadcast coast to coast every week as a public service feature of Mutual. Your announcer, Jerry Coffer. This is the world's largest network, the Mutual Broadcasting System.